to another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's episode is entitled Napoleonic Weakness. Or you're not alone. It's a phrase that I made up for the sake of today's episode. So we're going to talk about three films that all reference the man Napoleon Bonaparte in different ways, some sort of more conspicuous than others. And in watching all these films together this week, I can't help but notice that there's a clear commonality that underpins all of them. And I feel like they all, and I think this is potentially why they all make references to Napoleon, we're going to explore this obviously in more detail throughout the show, is because they all seem to be tapping into some aspect of masculine weakness, where we see instances of insecurity or frailty or fragility in a masculine figure. And I think between the three of the films, they kind of span perhaps the spectrum of masculine weakness, from the very, very feeble to the almost, you know, conventionally or obviously strong in a sort of a physical sense kind of thing. You'll see what I mean as we sort of traverse this spectrum throughout today's show. And so when we're talking about these films, I want you to know, obviously, from the start, I'm not saying that all of the references to Napoleon in all of these films are necessarily, you know, equal and equally related to like the same aspects of Napoleon's life. But I think they all do explore this concept of masculinity in between the three and do scoop quite deeply and cover a lot of ground in that area of masculine weakness. But why specifically Napoleonic weakness? I'm not just saying that because, you know, we're using the word, but we're actually going to talk about a specific brand of masculine weakness and sort of where that comes from and why it might be different to conventional ideas of masculine weakness as well. But hopefully, you know, I think this will all make a little bit more sense as we carry through and talk about the films. And those films are, the first one's going to be Napoleon Dynamite from 2004, directed by Jared Hess. We're then going to move on to the newly released film from Ridley Scott called Napoleon, starring Joaquin Phoenix. Then we're going to finish off with Elia Kazan's 1951 film, A Streetcar Named Desire. But let's kick things off now with Napoleon Dynamite. And, I mean, this is a pretty straightforward film in terms of what it's about. John Heder plays a young chap in high school called Napoleon Dynamite, who's this kind of nerdy, weird guy that lives in rural Idaho with his older brother, who's a bit of a funny fella, and their uncle comes to look after them while their grandma, who usually looks after them, is I think she's injured from a dune buggy accident or something like that. And I kind of want to talk about this one in terms of exploring the idea of masculine weakness kind of through this very talk about our kind of traditional understanding of our traditional conception of what masculine weakness looks like in a kind of recognizable and relatable and sort of, as a result, a comedic sense. This is sort of we have an archetypal weakling before us in this film, and I want to sort of flesh out how those traits are communicated and kind of what his destiny is as this kind of archetypal weakling. How do we find him becoming individuated in the specific world that he lives in? So in terms of breaking down how he's sort of archetypally, he's in sort of an archetypal weakling or an archetypally feeble, let's say, archetypally masculine feeble character. I mean, we've got his general appearance, obviously, and then he's got the classic glasses and frizzy hair, and he's very skinny and slender and awkward. And, you know, that's why we sort of get the irony in his name. You know, someone who looks like that is very sort of slender and he's kind of fragile, being called someone like Napoleon Dynamite obviously has a element of sort of comedic irony. And I think it's important to note as well, just for the sake of today's show, that he actually wasn't originally named that. I can't remember what his name was when the short film came out of this, when Hess made this, I think it was a student film to begin with. But he heard the name Napoleon Dynamite somewhere in life, I think somewhere in his travels somewhere, and he's like, I have to have a character or a film called that. And I think he realized that the film would have a little bit more oomph about it if he sort of gave him this. I don't know if he thought of it to be ironic at the time, but it certainly has an ironic quality to it in that he's so not a strong, tyrannical, globe-trotting warlord. He's complete opposite of that. But I want to talk about how he's got this sense of feebleness, but it's not simply because there's a clear rejection of masculinity in his life. And I think this is a really important point to make from the outset today. And it made me think a lot about being at school and the kinds of guys that were kind of a little bit nerdy, or, you know, I myself was a little bit of a nerdy guy at school, and the sort of traits of nerdy people. When we talk about archetypally or stereotypically weak male characters, I think we can very easily fall into, this is probably more in the stereotypical sense, fall into this sort of sense that it's a rejection of masculinity. It's all about kind of being weak and having skinny arms and being like, hey, you know, you're the football jock, get away from me. When we see Napoleon Dynamite, there is an embrace of masculinity. It's not so much that he doesn't want to be masculine, right? Because he loves drawing his warriors and he's obsessed with weapons and fighting. And, you know, Kip, his brother, who's also sort of equally feeble, is also like wants to be a cage fighter. And they go to that Rex Kwon Do thing, that karate class. And then it reminded me a lot when I was rewatching this film about, like, it's not so much that the weaker guys at school or when you're growing up reject masculinity. It's quite, they actually really want to be more masculine and very often have, like, if you think about someone, like, I've been watching Peep Show recently, and David Mitchell's character in that, he is a bit of like a, he's not a strong guy, but he's obsessed with war. Like, it's not that there's a lack of interest in masculinity. It's just what I think we get from this film is the sense that a kind of true nourishing kind of masculinity is kind of unattainable in certain environments. It's not that there isn't a want for that. It's that it's not attainable. It's not, it doesn't exist. It's not in high supply in this town that they live in. And so we sort of see that all the potential sources of healthy masculinity are kind of insufficient for Napoleon. You know, as I mentioned, the Rick Kwon Do guy, he literally goes to pay money to learn how to be a good fighter. But the guy presenting the classes is a scam artist. He's got his uncle Rico, but he's wearing a toupee, which is kind of like the, you know, a very clear metaphor for a kind of forced masculinity. And he's, you know, living in the past in his schoolboy days. And even the school jock, who I don't think has any lines in the film, but even just looking at him, you get this sort of depressing, he's got this sort of depressing aura about him where we're like, that guy's life is going to go nowhere. It's kind of depressing looking at him, thinking that his life is going, like, dude, get some hobbies, get some passions, get smart or something, because your life is going to go downhill so fast in this small town, thinking that being a high school hero is going to be enough to kind of give you a life that's fulfilling and that sort of thing. So it's sort of that he, in this world that Napoleon lives in, there's no kind of role model for healthy, beneficial masculinity in his world. And so his liberation or his individuation has to be found in somehow breaking free of the world he's in and becoming one or embracing or learning how to wield, a bit like almost like a hero's journey kind of way, wielding the foreign, breaking out of the world he finds himself in, breaking out of the culture that he lives within, and embracing that and integrate that into his life. And I think that's perfectly encapsulated in the famous last scene, or the famous climactic scene, the dance scene in the film. And, you know, there's no shortage of films where a boy learning to dance becomes the way that he individuates himself. It's something about, you know, becoming, getting in step with the natural flow, the natural rhythms of the world, the natural beat of the world, kind of having a consistency, being able to embody a kind of consistency with the aura of existence, you know, tapping into something transcendent of the real, of the immediately material, of the observable in your sort of close surroundings, trying to tap into something kind of ethereal or something like that. And the style of the music, the song Canned Heat by Jamiroquai, is so against the grain of rural Idaho, right? It's truly a sort of foreign energy in that particular setting, and so hence, you know, while the crowd jumps up because it's like they've been introduced to something they've never heard before, a bit like a sort of Marty McFly in Back to the Future, where they hear the sound they never heard before, kind of thing. And I think it's also worth mentioning as well that the source of the music comes from the tape that's given to him by Kip's girlfriend LaFonda, or whatever her name is. And, like, we even get this sort of imagery of her being kind of foreign to the Idaho town that they're from. And if it's like, we meet her when she gets off of a bus. Like, she's coming from afar. She's coming from a faraway land, in this case, Detroit. And it's also, I think it is worth mentioning as well that she's the only black character that has any sort of, I think she's like the only black character in the whole film. But this is a very mostly white, like, white American town. And it's like the introduction of something new, something that's not local, is what sort of liberates these people from what I would call a very sort of stale culture. And I think there's and interesting as well, LaFonda is Kip's girlfriend, so it's not just Napoleon, but Kip who becomes sort of is able to break free of this rut through the introduction of La Fonda to their world. She almost has this kind of, speaking of things being ethereal, she kind of has this enigmatic, ethereal entity-like quality to her as well. And I think that the film, I don't want to say this is a particularly, in sort of these sort of inconspicuous yet noticeable terms, I feel like the film kind of advocates almost for like against the kind of fascistic way that we fetishize entrenched culture. Like it's really a push away from letting cultures rut or go stale, or sort of cultures rotting from a sort of from going stagnant kind of thing, which is sort of like a real problem that America has with its culture, that it, particularly in middle and rural America, where it has this such an obsession with Americana, and you can't help but think that, you know, there's a point at which that goes stale and starts to rot, and you do need to sort of freshen things up and try something new. So it's almost like the destiny of the feeble masculine is to become one with something that transcends the culture that's become habitual to them. So in understanding that about this film, is it simply the case that masculine weakness is only a problem, or it's only a game that needs to be solved, or a puzzle that needs to be solved by the feeble, by the disempowered in a given system? Does masculine weakness ever appear in someone who dominates that given system, who is a advocate for that culture? Well, I think it's time now to move on to our next film. And before we do that, I just remind you, I listen to Sacred Cinema here on 2XX98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, and also consider jumping onto our website. Consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. But we're going to move on to now Ridley Scott's new epic starring Joaquin Phoenix. And this one is pretty much Napoleon's highlight reel, but with a huge emphasis on this juxtaposition between his reputation, his stature as this, as I mentioned before, the sort of globe-trotting military force that the world had never seen before, the likes of which the world had never seen, at least in that era. And this hold that his beloved Josephine, played by Vanessa Kirby, had on him. And I knew a little bit about Napoleon before I saw this film, and I'm really glad that this was kind of the emphasis of the film, because I think it's such an interesting, I think it's so relevant to today and the way that global geopolitics is operating, and you know, questions around masculinity, which are very much on the tip of everyone's tongue at the moment, or have been for the last couple of years. I think it's a really interesting story and profound story to tell this time. And I want to talk about it through this lens of how even the most powerful men in the world, like the most objectively powerful men in the world, still have very profound weaknesses. In fact, their weaknesses are almost just as big as their strengths, let's say. So there's a good argument when we're talking about Napoleon. We're talking about one of the world's most powerful people in human history, at least contextually speaking. He was the most powerful man in the world when he was alive, and during a very sort of powerful time, right? Like, he was during a time when nations were growing and getting bigger and stronger. Yet when we watched the film, we realized that he had a profound weakness, and that was Kirby's character of Josephine. And this is what I mean by this phrase of Napoleonic weakness, which is descriptive of this concept of where a person can be at the mercy of another person despite maximal material power. So Napoleon was a man who was the most powerful man in the world, but despite that, was still at the mercy of another person. And interestingly, he's a masculine figure and she's a feminine figure, as we understand it, right? And I also couldn't, I know this isn't a focus of the film, but I couldn't help think about as well as watching the film. And I always think this when I watch war movies. I'm like, what is the motivation of all those men that died in such horrific circumstances during all these battles, like freezing in the ice and getting swords going through your eyeballs and stuff like that? And you can't help but think that there's some kind of loyalty that is so, think about how loyal one must be to another person or another people, their community, to go out and sacrifice that much, that level of pain. Because we've talked about this over the last couple of weeks, this idea of the relationship that people have to one another, and how this that we're so much more defined by our interconnectedness than our own individual identities, or that idea of sort of systems theory and everyone and everything being interconnected. And when you look at a war scene in a movie like this, you kind of think, how profound were the connections? How profound were the senses of love that these people had for their wives and for their children and for their country at large to be able to put themselves in that position? You have to be almost mad to have that much, you know, love for those you're trying to protect. And I don't care how big your paycheck is, no one's going to take a sword through the face just because they're going to get paid to do it. I think when we think about war and we think about sacrifice like that, we have to engage with the emotional elements of it that men particularly felt that they, you know, that they were at the mercy of when they went out and did that sort of thing. But we're focusing particularly on Napoleon. And I think sort of that does lead us to the question of how and why can someone have such a strong hold on another person and put them through so much and challenge their strength, their such profound strength? How can someone have that much allure and that much of a vibrant, how can someone be so vibrant that someone that powerful can be distracted from what they are otherwise by that person? Well, in recent years, we've spoken a lot about masculinity, and we mostly talk about it in negative terms. You know, we've got this phrase, toxic masculinity, and that sort of thing. And I think that is a very simplistic way of looking at masculinity, because I think one of the strengths of this film, and it's got a lot of criticism, but I really loved this one aspect of it particularly, where it portrayed Napoleon's appetite. Like, when I think of Napoleon, I think of a tyrant, you know, a guy running around on a horse killing people. But it did really try very hard to portray his appetite, or probably more accurately put, his subjective appetite for peace. And much of this long film is about conveying the diplomacy in which he attempted to engage with the other monarchs, the Russian guy and the Austrian guy, and how he keeps talking about, like, I don't actually like war, I like peace. Now, whether you agree with whether he was lying or not, this is such a focus of the film. And I think part of that is because it works so well in Josephine and this thirst for peace, or this thirst for Josephine and this thirst for peace being symbols for one another in Napoleon's life, right? Where his love for Josephine is sort of it's the personification of his yearning for peace, really, at the end of the day. That really, in this archetypally strong tyrannical masculine figure, we have this longing. We do ironically have this longing for the peaceful, for the harmonious, for the comforting. Or in that sense, sorry, what I mean is, like, for that which is comfortable. And once you might hear that, I'm like, Jimmy, that's kind of hard to believe. When I think about, you know, someone who's a raging warlord killing people and chopping their heads off and that sort of thing, I don't really think of someone that's yearning for comfort. But then if we do think about the really angry people in the world, you could sort of define them by this kind of, this person who is fearful or totally just disagreeable with discomfort. And wanting to, you know, if you think about sort of, you know, like a Scarface type figure, there is this longing for, you know, for not just a recreation and having a good time, but being sort of in a space of comfortability, being sort of towering at the top of things, sitting on a throne, feeling like they're the, you know, living a life of luxury, living like when you think about, you know, the famous, you know, the South American guy, the Pablo Escobar, you know, that shot of, you know, when we think about a guy like that, we think of him in a big house, a life of luxury. When people climb to the top, they have this kind of yearning to be the king of something, not on the battlefield as an end, but rather a means to achieve this sort of this lush kind of luxurious lifestyle. And that certainly comes across in this film, where Napoleon really just wants to get in bed with Josephine. We see those moments where they embrace that is this moment of solace for him. And so we have to see the yearning for comfort in someone who has got blood running out down their mouth. You know, despite the fact that they are so aggressive and violent, they do have this yearning for comfort in the same sense that they have a yearning for love, that they have a yearning for intimacy, particularly with, you know, a woman in this case. And I think to sort of sum that up really well is the last quote of the film. If you haven't seen it yet, I won't give it away. But the order in which Napoleon ranks the things that matter to him in life, of course, France is there, i.e. culture. You know, speaking of what we were talking about before with Napoleon Dynamite and, you know, cultural rut and wanting to transcend it, that's sort of the third thing. And then the second thing, it sort of lifts up this idea of family and brethren. We're getting closer to this idea of interconnectivity between people. And then the final thing is, obviously, you know, his love for Josephine is paramount above culture, above community, is an attachment to a singular feminine figure. So it seems that on one hand we have this, well, so I guess on both hands we kind of have this longing for more, or this profound sense of desire. Whether we're a weak masculine or a strong masculine figure, we always have this sort of dormant desire for more. There's a sense of desire at the heart of all men, from the weak to the strong. So is there a film that kind of maps this out and simultaneously maybe gives us a little bit of direction in terms of how to reconcile this kind of curse that it seems to infect all men in a way, or all masculine figures? There's this curse for more, this curse for desire despite any kind of individual strength. Well, at this point, it's time to move on to our third and final film here, and that's A Streetcar Named Desire by Elia Kazan from 1951. And it's a very famous thing, obviously, it's the play, and there's been two films of it, and there's been the Simpsons episode appropriating it. But I want to talk about it sort of and how it represents, you know, the disruption of the seemingly unified, this unified, seemingly unified union between a very powerful man, or is he, you know, played by Marlon Brando, and this union between him and his vulnerable wife, Stella. And the disruption that takes place of that union at the hands of this vivacious, and I'm going to call her sort of like the alternative feminine. You know, you've got Stella, played by Kim Hunter, and then you've got Blanche, played by Vivian Leigh, who is kind of like, for Stanley, is, you could say, metaphorically. And we've got this sisterly dynamic, which I think is symbolic of the you know, the dichotomized feminine, with Stella being sort of like the reliable, quiet feminine, and you've got Vivian Leigh being the kind of ditzy and exciting, glamorous feminine, and Stanley having to come to terms with, you know, the life that he's decided upon with Stella being disrupted by Vivian Leigh's character. And it's not necessarily on romantic terms, although there is a slight hint of that, of course. It's the disruption of that dynamic that's been set in stone, and what that does to him. And we're going to focus, even though it's a film where Blanche is really the main character, and we're certainly going to focus on her, despite this week being about masculinity, we're going to firstly talk about all the other men as well in this film. A bit like when we talked about Thelma and Louise, we talked about sort of the lack of a reliable masculine figure for the feminine to fall into, and sort of how these sort of, I know it sort of sounds like a big mishmash now, but we're going to talk about sort of how for these men who have varying degrees of weakness within them, or different types of weakness, how they are able to deal with this force of nature that is Blanche DuBois when she comes into their world and offers an alternative, and offers something that in one hand is, you know, is very scintillating and stimulating, and but also somewhat of a burden in another sense. But let's go through it. So the first aspect of this film I think we need to touch on is this illusion of the purely harmless, gentle man. So before we talked about Napoleon Dynamite and this archetypally weakling kind of character, and I guess some of the characters in this film are kind of like the dark side or the dramatic version of that kind of gentle man that we don't consider to be too masculine at the beginning. And I want to talk about how the purely harmless gentle man is an illusion, both in respect of, you know, he's lying to he can cause it's something that has that backfires both on the self and also backfires on the other. So hanging over Blanche's head throughout this film is obviously the death of her past love. And I actually think that this is one of those few cases where the censorship of obviously this character was in the play as originally homosexual and is discriminated against that. And that's why he ends up killing himself. And I think it's one of the few instances where the censorship of the film almost makes the film a little bit more timeless, in that sense. We don't you know, associate homosexuality with masculine weakness anymore. And I think by describing him with words like soft and gentle and him loving poetry, it kind of opens up his character. It makes him a little bit more malleable, makes him a little bit more, we can deal with him in kind of in any time period, rather than sort of limiting him to that sort of stereotypical flavor that he had potentially in the original play. But we have this idea that being a kind of a weak or a soft man is something that doesn't necessarily garner respect from the feminine, and that she almost feels burdened by the fact that she wasn't drawn to him as much as she might be drawn to another fellow, and that can lead to, you know, destruction of the self for that masculine figure. And so while we see him as sort of this innocent, gentle, harmless man, he causes a great deal of harm on himself. And this is calling back to a lot of stuff we've talked about before, especially when we did like Beau is Afraid and that sort of thing. But then also we have to take the character of Mitch, another kind of gentle figure. We see that as the story progresses, And he has this allure of being a gentleman, but he does end up just being another man that just wants to get some. And we see that his gentleness is simply another means or another route that another man might use through sort of brutish masculinity. He uses it through this sort of sly, foxy kind of snake in the grass kind of weakness in him, and ends up that, you know, the burden of that ends up falling on Blanche, at least for a few instances, and in a greater sense. But we don't want to go into sort of all the what ifs, you know, of this plot. But I think that the Mitch character is the example of a weak man whose weakness falls on, you know, a sort of conventionally weak man whose weakness, the burden of the weakness falls on the feminine there. But then we also have, on the other hand, we have the illusion of the impenetrable strong man. So, you know, there's no purely weak men that are completely harmless. There's also no purely strong men that are completely reliable. Just because a guy is strong doesn't mean he's someone that we can count on. Of course, here we have the Stanley character played by Marlon Brando. And people often talk about Brando's performance. It's one of the greatest acting performances of all time and everything. And I don't think it's remarkable just in and of itself. It's that this allure that he has with his sweaty, dirty shirts and his bare chest and his perfect face, it exhibits this sense of Napoleonic weakness, in that he's this almost perfectly handsome, perfectly masculine man, yet he is still rendered insecure. He is still a guy that has a great deal of emotional feels a great deal of emotional pain just from a few little chatterings, a few little sly remarks from a woman who he is so much stronger than, simply by her just, you know, making a little joke or insulting him based on his socioeconomic status. He just hits the roof. And we said that there is that vulnerability in those men to be, despite the fact that they can have that kind of stereotypical strength about them, they can still hit the roof. And the reference to the Napoleonic Code in this one, it lifts up this idea that sort of husband and wife, or the masculine and the feminine, are kind of inextricably tied together, and that leads to a great deal of issues. The fact that we have this inextricable connection between the two of us intensifies, sort of between the masculine and feminine, intensifies those differences. And this is where Vivien Leigh's performance is so worth noting, because in her being in the same house, being next door, you know, there's no soundproofing between these rooms, being in Marlon Brando's world, being in his head, being in his psyche, in all of her vivaciousness, in all of her sort of scintillating and stimulating diction and her movement and her presentation, it's so distracting. It's so attractive, not just in a sexual sense, but in a non-sexual sense too. She can't be ignored. He's someone that constantly has to deal with this constantly chattering woman with all her fox furs and feathers. He can't not look at her. So the result of this, it seems to me, leads to this kind of chaotic situation where we see the manifestation of the natural dominance of the masculine over the feminine, where this close, intense tension between the two, when it reaches its limit, we always see the masculine sort of win over the feminine due to this natural unfair physical difference. And you could say, by being very reductionist, that this does sort of account for why human history is sort of seemingly underscored by this eternal tension between feministic protest and feminine subservience, where we have this paradox where the mistreatment of the feminine leads to the protest of the feminine, but which will then lead to sort of the mistreatment of the feminine, then the protest of the feminine, and sort of that accounts for why I suppose the feminine is so often conflicted by whether to protest or be subservient in the face of dominating men. But let's try and tie everything together now. So we have this sort of recognizable idea of what masculine weakness looks like, but we have to also accept that even in the strongest of men, there is always this profound and palpable weakness for women, or more symbolically, that the sense or this yearning for peace and comfort that all men really do want to find in the feminine. So perhaps it's really important to remember that the relationship between the masculine and the feminine will never be sort of characterized by a sense of distance, but rather this unavoidable sense of tight and intense, inescapable connection. So perhaps rather than claiming a sense of power in independence, men need to come to terms with this eternal desire for the feminine and all the dangers that can come from denying that weakness. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here, and have a good week.